The following presentation was recorded at the 1999 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
The English language, we ought to do very, very well with this history presentation, teaching history. My goal this afternoon is not to necessarily inspire you about history. I'd like for you to go away this afternoon with some tools in your tool chest to teach history in the classroom. So what I'm going to share with you, most of it is on the handout for those of you who have one. Those of you who do not, I do have overheads that I'll put up on the board or on the wall, and you'll be able to copy down whatever notes you feel is appropriate. So we'll take right off here, and what I'm going to do is begin by looking at the lesson triangle, which I believe applies to any subject. When I'm teaching principles of teaching, this is one of the things we look at and think about and consider for any classroom situation. This is designed for the secondary level, but I think that some of this information would be very helpful even on the primary level. What you see here is what I call the lesson triangle of fact, skill, and concept, which is a basic framework within which any lesson can be developed, no matter if you're talking about math or even English or history. The percentages may vary back and forth as to how much you give to teaching facts and how much you teach to in respect to skills and how much you teach in respect to concept. But we say that every lesson should include these three, varying the percentages one way or another for your particular purpose or the classroom. So I'm just going to begin by saying that this will be the framework with which I show you or talk to you about teaching history. We're going to come at it from the idea that you're going to walk into the classroom and you have a certain number of facts that you want to teach to the students. You also have a certain skill that you want them, when they walk out the door, they are able to do this particular skill. For example, it may be one like reading the elevations on a map. Now, 12th grader, 11th grader should already know that. But amazingly, there are a lot of people who graduate from high school that if you gave them a map and asked them to explain or asked them to even tell you what the elevation was or is of a particular area in the country, they wouldn't be able to read the map. That's a skill. Okay? Concepts are what grow out of facts and skills. Remember, this will apply to any classroom situation, but particularly to a history class. Concepts are such things as may be discussed when you talk about federalism, or you talk about the political left or the political right on a high school level. These are concepts that flow out of facts and skills. And so what we'll be doing today is we'll be looking after a bit at lessons, and some of the folks up here have books and they have papers, and if we have time, I'm actually going to have you design a lesson and to get a volunteer for somebody to come up and teach it. See how that works. But first, before we get to the practical development of a lesson, we'll talk about teacher preparation. I personally think that the best history teachers are the ones who have done the preparation work that I'm going to talk about here in the next couple of minutes. Because, let me jump back down for just a moment, there are a lot of history teachers who can teach facts. In fact, you can almost, anybody can do that, anybody in this room can pick up a book and choose the facts that you want to teach out of that book, present them, and have the students learn them. Skills is a little bit of another level up. Perhaps a person doesn't know how to use lines of latitude and longitude to find a position on a map. I wouldn't try to embarrass anybody right now. It'd be interesting to find out. Pass out a piece of paper here and see how many could actually tell me what the line of latitude and longitude is for Meadville or something close to there. But it's even more difficult to teach a concept. And I'll be really fair with you. It takes a little experience. It might even take a little gray hair. I don't want to go that far along. But it takes a little time to pick up enough facts, enough skills, enough experience to build concepts. I didn't say that to discourage anybody, actually to encourage you. Because if you step into the classroom the first year, you're a 19-year-old young lady or young fellow, and you're going to teach history. And you heard all of this stuff about how you're supposed to teach facts, and you're supposed to teach skills, and you're supposed to teach concepts. And it may seem to you that you're awfully short on concept. It wouldn't surprise me a bit. Because it does take an immense amount of material, an immense amount of background and context to be able to do a very good job with the conceptual side of history. But here I'm going to try to explain to you what you can do or how you can begin to develop what it takes to be the kind of history teacher who walks in and is able to bring to the fore the concept so that a high school student walks out of there inspired and awed by the historical events and his responsibility in the world he lives in. Number one is to develop a cohesive worldview. Now, started with perhaps the hardest one, because unfortunately, a great number of people do not have, hardly have, any worldview at all. So they bring to the history class not a framework within which to place their thinking and their facts and their skills and letting their concepts develop, but rather they come in just, well, with no framework. And as a result of not having a framework, then you go into the classroom, out you go, in you come, out you go. At the end of the year, you wonder if you accomplished anything. I can tell you, the teachers who have gotten a hold of a worldview, when they're teaching world history, you sense the urgency in their voice. You sense the energy behind what they're saying, and you get that idea that they have something they want to tell you pretty badly. And they're using the vehicle of history to let that worldview flow through to you. And that's what I'm talking about here. There are three things that I have that are involved with a right or a cohesive worldview. Number one is a right view of God. And letter A is a right view of God. And number one is His sovereignty. His sovereignty. Who has not taught a history class and wondered at the events that unfolded, why they happened the way they did? Were they coincidental? Did they just happen to be that way? Well, for the secular teacher or the person who does not have a view of God at all, what else does he have to go on except to say that chance and circumstance and so on resulted in this? Well, that would take all the fire out of me. If I had to tell you that this story, this event that happened in history, this person who came to the fore at a particular given moment to lead a nation or something like that, that it was just coincidental, there is no explanation. We begin with a correct view of the sovereignty of God. And I'll use a story later on to demonstrate that a little further. Number two is His benevolence or His kindness. His thoughts toward man, His thoughts toward the human race. You see this banner here going all the way around the auditorium. I didn't put it up, but it demonstrates it very clearly. The acts of God in history. It is not true that God sat up there and said to Himself, well, I see I've had enough of it with these German people. I think what I'm going to do is raise them up an Adolf Hitler, and I'm going to make it really tough for them, and we'll just watch them suffer, and we'll have a lot of fun doing it. No. That's not the right view. But the third one says something about that view, and that is His justice. Number two could rightly have been called His mercy as well as His benevolence. So we begin with a right view of God. And the historian, the wise historian, is always stepping back and looking at the picture and saying, "But God, what were you doing? What can I learn about you in this event that transpired, this event that occurred? How should I be different having studied this chapter in history and realized that you were at work?" For example, Abraham Lincoln understood this. That's what he said one time while he was pacing around in the White House during the Civil War. I don't have an exact quote, but he said he, in his grief, in his misery over the people who were dying like flies, made this comment: "I have a sneaking suspicion that this war will not end till every last drop of blood is out of God's cup of wrath over the whole slavery issue and the things that were going on." I don't have the exact quote. There you go. You can read the second inaugural address and you'll pick up that quote. What was he doing? He was stepping back from his responsibilities and his duties and from the war that was going on, and he was saying, "God, what is this about? What's going on? Why is this thing dragging out over 3 or 4 years? We thought we were on the right side and we're against slavery. I mean, surely, God, you must be on our side. And if you're on our side, then we ought to win and this thing ought to end quickly." But upon reflection, he said, "No, there's some other things at work. That it may be true that I'm on the right side. It may be true that I'm advancing the right cause, but it's also true that this nation shed the blood of many and tore families apart and separated babies from their moms and did all of these terrible things. And it seems to me," said Abraham Lincoln, "that the cup of wrath is being poured out on this nation. And this war cannot end until it is satisfied." Whether he was right or wrong, I'm not here to debate. I'm just pointing out to you what it means to step back and say, "God, what were you doing? What do you mean by this?" And learning something about Him. And then being able to project that into the experiences that we have today. Secondly, letter B here is a right view of nature. And number one is, we live in a fallen world. We live in a fallen world. I learned this from Francis Schaeffer, I think, or at least it was hammered home to me at a time when I was probably had a growing perfectionism that was not necessarily a good one. When he said that when you're working in your churches and you're working with people and you're teaching school and you're raising families, and all those things, don't ever forget, you do not live in a perfect world. You live in a fallen world. And though it has been redeemed, that fallenness tags along. And it affects the way things happen and the way events take place. Very, very important point there when you're thinking of what has happened in our world. For example, a question that is raised very, very often by an atheist or an agnostic is, "Can you explain to me the suffering of the innocent people in our world?" It's probably the question that's been asked me the most often, the most serious question to be asked in a place like Franklin County Prison or on the street somewhere. People want to know, why is that true? Well, none of us have a really, really, really good answer. But it just impacts or brings home that point that, in fact, our world is fallen, and we experience the effects of it. And it doesn't just touch those who are guilty, it touches those who are not guilty as well. And so the events of history demonstrate that very, very clearly. Secondly here, a right view of nature. Nature is neutral. It is affected by man. The world we live in, it's cause and effect. Hosea chapter 4. Let me read you a passage from the Bible that helps to demonstrate what it means to develop a right view of God in the view of in the field of nature. Hosea chapter 4, here's a few verses for you. Hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel. For the Lord hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood toucheth blood. Now listen carefully. Therefore shall the land mourn, or nature, and every one that dwelleth therein shall languish with the beast of the field and with the fowls of heaven. Yea, the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. There is your scriptural passage on environmentalism. The answer, I can say with a certain level of integrity, at least to our polluted streams and all of that, does not lie in legislation. It lies in the change in the morality of the human race. Where does this apply to history? Well, Israel was once a well-watered land. When they came into the land, it was a land flowing with milk and honey. Trees, when you read the story, there were trees all over the place in Israel when they first came into the land. How many trees do you find there now? Over their mountains and their hills. Very, very, very few. Now, it is true that there is... Israel has been transformed into an agricultural land again, but it languished as God's people moved away from Him. And so when we study history, we study geography, and we learn that nature is affected. Letter C here is a right view of the individual. Number one, individuals are unique in the eye of God. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that, now honestly now, do you think that you will, by the time you exit this world, will you have an impact on this world? Will your life have made a significant difference so that history is altered because of you? Chances are, at least for me, when I think about it, I think, well, who is little old me? That's a good question. And it's actually true. Who am I? In the stream of world events. Well, in a very real sense, nothing more than a drop in the bucket, or not even that much. But in another sense, each individual is very, very, very unique in the eyes of God. And I believe each of us have been created with a special purpose and a particular purpose in mind, and we do make a difference in the world we live in. Each person is unique. And secondly, each individual has a purpose. I'd like for you to listen as I read from 2 Timothy chapter 2, another passage that helps to develop our concept of God and how He works in the affairs of men. I'm getting there. 2 Timothy 2. But in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also of wood and of earth, and some to honor and some to dishonor. If a man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor, sanctified and meet for the master's use and prepared unto every good work. And it goes on to say, flee also youthful lust and so on. I used to wonder what that passage meant. Let me explain it just a little bit differently. Well, let me ask a question first. What do you do with a person like Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill or Napoleon or Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin or any of these men? Mikhail Gorbachev, Ronald Reagan, name the list of people that you might consider to have affected the world in the 20th century greatly. First question to ask is, were any of them Christians? Second question is, how did they get to the position that they came to? How did God choose among men? Can Christians do this kind of work? Well, this passage says that God has a great household. It's the entire earth. And it says that in His household, He has various kinds of vessels. It's like somebody said to me one time, if you go down to the White House and you walk through the White House, you'll find some very, very nice, ornate kinds of place settings. And they're on display. You find them in cabinets if you go through the White House. You find all these nice pieces all over the place. Do you think they have any garbage cans? Well, sure they do. The White House needs A, B, C, D, E, various kinds of vessels. God needs them too. Does he need somebody to lead England through World War II? Yes. Does that make him a Christian? No. He needed a vessel somewhere, and he found the person who had suited himself for that to lead the nation of England through the war. When you read about Abraham Lincoln's rise to the presidency in the United States, you can't help but say, no, look, there was something unusual at work in that activity. He shouldn't have made it. You know, when it came to the National Convention, the Republican National Convention, he was confronted by leading Republicans who said, you've got to drop this slavery issue from your platform totally, or there's no way that you can win this election. And Abraham Lincoln said, well, then count me out. If I have to drop it from my platform to run for the presidency, then I'm through. They decided to stick with it. He won it anyway. By all counts, by looking at the statistics and all of that, you'd have said he can't do it. But he rose. God chose him as a vessel at that point. Not making him a Christian, not trying to unchristianize him. I'm just simply saying that when you have that view, that God makes people uniquely and he chooses them uniquely for special jobs, and you don't have to make them Christians or non-Christians, that helps you out a lot. You don't have to say George Washington was a Christian. But you can say God raised up George Washington at the beginning of this nation with his particular characteristics, personality, and perspective as a deist, put him into the office to bring about the events that came about. All right, you can say that, and you can point to 2 Timothy and say that's what happened, or that's why George Washington was raised up at that time. We're talking about teacher preparation. How does this all happen? Over a period of time. You have to work at developing a solid worldview. I'm still working on mine, by the way. Don't in any way think that I have already arrived. Number two, and now we get down to some more practical details. I really do want you to be able to walk out that door with some ideas about what you can do to be a good history teacher. Know the facts. You cannot bypass this, and some of it is just hard work. We could put in here dates. We could put in here geography. We could put in here a lot of different things. You're going to have to do the brute hard work of gathering together the facts of history. That means read and read and read and read some more. And when you're done with that, read some more. I never get done studying for a history lesson. I just quit when I'm out of time. I don't know about the rest of you who've been teaching for a while, but that's the way I do. I have my main book that I'm using, I have a parallel book, and then I have a specific book normally in my office that I'm reading. Sometimes I never get to the third book, but I obviously read the first one, the text that I'm going to be using. And then I like to read another text that parallels that one. And then I like to read a specific event that is encapsulated in that lesson to get some details about it. You've got to know the facts. And I've taught school now for 20 years, but I'm going to tell you something. I still cannot teach a history class until I have read it word for word before I walk into that classroom. You've got to know it, or you can't teach it well. Letter A there, some suggestions on knowing the facts. Develop core resource material. What do I mean by that? Well, I have a world history book over in my office that is my core resource world history book. It's the one I know like the back of my hand. If you ask me a question about world history, if I don't know the answer, I know that it's in that book somewhere. I know just about the page and the chapter and where it is because that's the one I always refer to. Should you be a one-book person? No. But my point here is get one book that is really good and make sure that you master that book and know it thoroughly. And then that's your resource book. That's the one you go back to and you draw on. I have an American history book that I always refer to. I have a church history book that I refer to. I teach other texts, but those are my core resource materials. Okay? That's what I mean by core resources. Develop a library that if somebody asks you a question, you don't know the answer, you could find it in 5 minutes. Why does that help you? Well, very simply, you got 20 minutes to go until class time and you're scrambling to get your stuff put together. And if you got to go hunting it, looking for it, trying to find where this information is at, this fact that you were trying to verify or whatever, if you got to hunt for it, you're in trouble. But if you have that core set, then that's what you, yes.
Is that basically a compilation of college
texts? Yes, that's what I have. Of course, you can use high school texts. There are some very good high school texts that work well for this. But I really suggest you do this. For you elementary teachers, if you're teaching 5th and 6th grade history, I still think you should have at least a high school text that you draw from. That's what you kind of read from before you set out to teach this American history text. Okay? I don't think I can overemphasize that. That has stood me in good stead. I have no idea how many times. Preparing a sermon, preparing something like this or whatever, I go there, that's where I can find it. Number two, develop areas of expertise. Now there's a saying, there's a teacher proverb we use in Principles of Teaching. You should be a jack of all trades and master of at least one. Okay? And by that I mean there should be some area in history that you are very good at, that you do very, very well at. You cannot learn everything in history. You know that, I guess. So what you want to do is you want to have this broad-based core material that you draw from. Okay. Then what you want to do is you want to do a special study in some area that you are going to. That's what you're expert at. That's what you do very well at. Maybe it's church history. Maybe it's the history of Germany. Maybe it's the history of Europe. Maybe it's the history of Russia. Maybe it's American history. History of Pennsylvania, I don't know, something that the rest of the people or the rest of the teachers in your school or even in the community know that if they have a question on Germany, they could call you and you'll probably know at least something about that. Okay? Now, it goes without saying that you don't want to put the cart before the horse. I would not suggest that you pull down off the shelf the rise and fall of the Third Reich, which is a history of World War II from Germany's perspective, before you have a fair understanding of European history and how it all fits. But if you decide yourself you want to really be good at World War II for some reason or another, well, you're going to read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich for sure. Okay, but you need that core material first, you understand? Then you go to the specific and you get really good in one area. Don't make the mistake of trying to learn everything. Okay, for me, I have always had a lifelong interest in almost anything. It doesn't matter whether it's history or sewing clothes or what it is. I haven't ever sewn a dress. That shows you how much interest I have in that, really. But no, things just interest me. But you do have to be selective and decide what you are going to camp on and do well at. Thirdly, develop geography skills. Couple of people sitting here in this audience who took piles and piles of World News Map tests from me when I was a teacher. No names, Michelle. I felt like we didn't really get it accomplished. It'd be interesting to give Michelle a test right now and see if she could still fill in all of those names in Europe and capitals and rivers and mountains and lakes and streams and all of that. Won't try her out. But I do know one thing. You cannot get a very thorough mastery of history, and you can't teach it unless you have a good feel for geography. You know where the place is. You have an idea. You can at least vaguely put your finger on the map where it belongs or where it is in existence. Don't neglect the development of geography skills. Letter D, develop research skills. I've already touched on this a little bit. the skill of finding material fast when you need to find it. And I don't know what all of your community standards are, anything like that, but for example, the newest thing on the market is internet. Properly controlled, it's a terrific resource of information that you can find fast. Nice thing about it, it hunts it up for you. You know, rather than you have to go hunting all over the place for it, you get in there and it gives you a little help and you get all kinds of information there real quick. There are other computer programs that work really well in that sense. But you don't have to be doing that if you learn how to research really well. Peter Hoover here spoke over the weekend, and regardless of whether you agree with him or disagree with him, the one thing I know about Peter is he's an excellent researcher. I've never been to a library with him, but people who have tell me that what happens is the librarians stand there and they watch him. The next thing you know, he's got 50 books out on the table and he's photocopying these three pages and these two pages and these five pages and compiling this pile of things out of about 50 different books precisely on the information he wants. Now, I can tell you he didn't learn that skill overnight. Okay, all he's learned to do that has made it possible for him to write books and get together this stuff really fast or get all this information together is he's learned how to research really well. He can find this stuff fast. Okay, develop those skills. I'm not teaching a class today on how to do research, but I'm just telling you, if you want to be a good history teacher, learn that skill. Finally, expand school and personal library with good books. Your school library. I don't know what you're doing with your libraries, but the years that I've been teaching, it's been very, very clear to me that any subject, a way to do some growth is to select some outstanding books in that subject area and get it in the library. Books that people will read, not books that people won't read. But if it's American history, find some that you know, well, you don't know, but if they actually pull the thing, if they take the time to get it off the shelf and start to read it, they'll finish it. Okay? There are books like that, believe it or not. History books that one can just plow right through and enjoy. I saw somebody over here with a James Michener book. I'm not a James Michener fan. But I will say that, so I'm not, don't go away from here saying that I'm saying that what you want to do is fill your library full of James Michener books. There's some problems with it. But having some interest in Poland, I got one of his books that are written novel style on it's entitled Poland. Read the book. Fascinating book. Almost guaranteed if you enjoy reading stories, you'd read the book. And you'd find out something about Poland as you read it. Okay, I only use that as an example so that you get an idea of what I mean. When you select something from the library, you don't want to get something that's being taught to third-year college students, as a college text and put it there. Who's going to read that? You might buy that, though, for your personal library, okay, and put it there as a resource, as a resource material, okay? At any rate, you've got to know the facts. A third level here, learn the skills of teaching history. And letter A there is to learn the art of storytelling. Storytelling ties it together better than anything else. And I have four things just to share with you, and then I'm going to share with you a story. And we'll see how it works. Number one, explain the setting. Not too thoroughly, but thoroughly enough that they understand what the story is about. Explain the setting. You have to know the story well enough to do that. Number two, include important details. Exclude clutter. Include important details. Exclude clutter. Now, I heard Brother John talking about this in this thing of teaching English. Said, get it down, you know, get the thing down so it's simple. I've heard good storytellers ruin their story by telling too many details. Details that didn't matter or didn't count for the purpose of telling the story. Okay? And that I've heard other stories Boy, there'd have just been a detail or so added in there to give it some real oomph. Okay? So when you're telling a story, especially to a history class, you want to keep it brief. You want to include the details that are important and exclude clutter. Third, to do it well, briefly outline the story ahead of time for yourself. Now, it depends on the kind of impact that I want it to have. If I consider this to be the core of what I have to say today, I'm going to take some time with that story. And I'm going to get a little piece of paper and I'm going to jot down at least the five steps that or the five things that I want to tell about this story. Okay? And make sure that I get it in there. A lot of my stories are told just kind of off the cuff. You don't do as well with those. You either have to kind of know the story, it's not going to come off so hot. Okay? But those are normally just in the flow of things. But my point here is, if you have prepared your lesson, and here's the story that is going to clinch what you're going to say, then take the time to briefly outline the story so that you do know it and you can tell it well. Fourthly, if you're really wanting to do it right, tell the story ahead of time to somebody, and it will help. I'm going to come back and we're going to tell a story here in just a minute, but first we'll finish here B, C, and D. Letter B is learn R&R, what I call R&R, rapid research. Already talked about that one up in letter D under know the facts, but here's a skill. Learn rapid research. C, learn the art of cartography, which means be able to draw a map. Have some map skills. Get it down on a piece of paper. To this day, wait till I get some overheads out here. I don't know what Brother John did with them all. Excuse me? Oh, yeah, I can use this. To this day, when I draw a little thing like this on the board, my students all know we're talking Israel and we're talking Mount Carmel there at that little jut and all of that. In fact, two of my students who got married were telling me that they went somewhere to what's that game that you draw the pictures and the other person is guessing what you're drawing? Is that Pictionary? And the word was Egypt. So the wife, she scribbled that thing down real fast and went like that. The husband said, Egypt! They'd learned just a little bit of cartography and it was good enough to gain them a point real fast. They had Pictionary. Of course, Pictionary doesn't count, but I can tell you it adds spice to what you're saying if you can somehow pictorially show with a map what's going on. And finally here, lesson P and P, preparation and presentation. We're going to talk about preparation here in a few minutes. But before we do that, let's just go back and take a look at a story and try to tie together some of the things that we've been talking about. In the development of a worldview, a right view of God, a right view of nature, a right view of the individual, and knowing the facts and so on. One of the things that Christian school teachers have struggled with, they're confronted with when they are teaching history, as all of the wars and all of the heroes in those wars and what to do with them, because we use Bob Jones University text here at this school for our American history class, as you can see them lying around here. And they are by nature fairly militaristic, so they don't make any effort at saying, in fact, they really glorify a person like Robert E. Lee and make him out to be quite a hero. Now, I'm not here in any way to say that they were not heroes in their own way, but what do you do when you're teaching history and you're running into these kinds of things? This looks to me to be the wrong kind of a pen, but maybe it'll work. We'll start off with a map here to develop a setting. I'm going to talk about a fight
a battle that occurred in the Civil War. This is the famous Mason-Dixon line. When you're telling a story, you always want to teach a few things while you're doing. Where's the Mason-Dixon line located, students? Excuse me? Between Maryland and Pennsylvania. All right. Here's a river that runs up around here like this. What's the name of that river? This is the Potomac River. It separates what two states? Virginia and Maryland. It gets over here into West Virginia, right? Here's a little town, South Central PA. Its name is Gettysburg. Over here's a little town, a big town, Hagerstown. Down here, right, located close to the Potomac River, is the town of Sharpsburg. And a little farther south is the little town of Harper's Ferry. And depending on how deeply you had been into the story already, you might be asking students, what happened at Harper's Ferry? And so forth and so on. There is a stream that flows through Gettysburg, down along close, down through or close to the eastern edge of Hagerstown, down by Sharpsburg, and eventually enters the Potomac River at Harper's Ferry. What is the name of that stream? Antietam. Thank you. This is a little stream, the Antietam, that flows out of South Central PA down through the valley there and finally into the Potomac River at Sharpsburg. I'm sorry, at Harper's Ferry. Here's the little town of Sharpsburg. Famous battle occurred here in Antietam in American history. And it was not particularly a turning point, but it was very significant in the Civil War, which we have been talking about, students, for the last number of weeks, last number of days. I want to tell you about that story today and explain to you how I want you to see how God in His sovereignty has caused events to happen. Thank you very much, Jonathan. There is a particular little crook in this Antietam River. I'm going to go down here, block this off, and show the Antietam flowing. This is an enlargement. And it comes down and makes a little hook back like this, goes around like this, and flows on down. I'm looking at about this area right here. Okay. The story I want to tell you occurs right in here. This is a significant crook in the Antietam River. Let me tell you what was happening. Washington, D.C. is located here to the east of this area. And in 1862, things did not look all that well for the North in their battle against the South. McClellan, who was the leader of the Union forces, was very cautious, and Robert E. Lee was outfoxing him at almost every battle. First battle of Bull Run was over. Second battle of Bull Run is over. We're going to be talking September, fall of 1862, and particularly September the 17th. Students, I want you to remember that. It's 1862. Second battle of Bull Run has been fought and lost. Over here is Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is being threatened by the South. That means that the people in that city, now just imagine if you lived there, they were frightened that General Lee was actually going to be able to march on Washington, D.C. itself. And so, of course, General McClellan was lining up his forces to protect Washington, D.C. The movements of the Southern Army were very, not all that obvious, but their idea was to move north and come between Washington, D.C. and the rest of the North. Of course, General McClellan was going to try to stop him. In that process of General Lee moving his forces north and General McClellan moving his forces east, they faced off near this little town of Sharpsburg, just east of it, very close to this little crook in the Antietam Stream. Two events that fascinate me about that battle I want to tell you about. The first one is that McClellan had somewhere around 70,000 men. 70,000 men plus, some historians say, another 50,000 in reserve that he could have brought up if he wanted to. General Lee had 40,000. Actually, he had begun to march with 50,000 and then did something that no good general ever does. When he got to this point, he split his forces into five groups and sent them out in five different directions. What most history books don't tell you, he actually at one point had but 15,000 men under his command at Sharpsburg against 70,000 plus. The amazing thing about the story is that General McClellan knew that was the case. How did he know it? Well, two of his infantrymen had been walking over the little mountains that are between his position and Sharpsburg, and they came across, as they were walking along, one of them kicked a little package on the ground. I'll let you decide if this was coincidentally or by God's direction. Picked up that little package and discovered that it was three cigars inside of a wrapper. Unwrapped those three cigars and discovered that they were the battle plans for General Lee for the next week or 2 weeks in their hands. They took the battle plans to McClellan immediately, and he looked at them, threw down his pen and pencil and said, "We've got them." Because it was obvious all he had to do was march across the mountain, crush the 15,000 people who were under. And then since the army was already separated, which is a battle tactic anyway, divide and conquer. Since Lee had already separated them, then just go and beat each of them separately because they had them divided. And in fact, if that had happened at that particular point, the Civil War would have never lasted until 1865. But some other events happened. Within 2 hours of the discovery of those plans, General Lee knew that they had been discovered. And so he flew into a panic. Actually, he did fly into a panic. He did what all good generals do. He assessed the situation and decided that he was going to do this. He took his 15,000 men and backed them into this position right here. Back into this nook in the Antietam Stream and threw up a bunch of mock tents out here. Now, let me tell you why he did that. He did that because he knew that General McClellan knew General Lee himself. And he knew that General McClellan knew that he, General Lee, was not stupid enough to set up camp in a crook like that, unless he had at least 40,000 men under his command. He really had only 15,000. My point here to you is this. A lot of high honors are given to General Lee for his leadership of the South as a warrior in the days of the Civil War. The fact of the matter, he was a desperate man who had to do desperate things, and they happened to work. He would never have done this in an ordinary circumstance. This is suicide, to back up with a river at your back or a large stream that you could not just cross quickly, facing 70,000 men with 15,000 men. But it was psychology. He knew that McClellan would say he can't be in there with 15,000 men, which is precisely what McClellan's memoirs say. He said General Lee would never do that. He has to have reserves somewhere. He's got to have at least 40,000 men under his command. He wouldn't do it. As a result, McClellan said, "We will not attack today. We need to call in reserves." And so he waited so many hours for reserves, and in the wait for reserves, you can believe that General Lee had sent out a hasty message to all of his dispersed army and said, "Return quickly! I need your help badly!" And so, sure enough, those Jeb Stuart and some of those who were out on their masquerades at other places came rushing back. And McClellan hung off just long enough
For General Lee to amass, guess how many men? 40,000. Precisely what McClellan thought he had to begin with. If McClellan had struck immediately with his 70,000, the war would have ended probably within a few months. Now, we don't know, of course. But it did not. The next day, September the 17th, when the fighting actually occurred, and for those, how many of you have ever been to Antietam? Okay. This is an insertion in the story. If you do not want to glorify war with your students, but you want to let them know about the realities of it, choose a battlefield where that is shown. I do not take my students to Gettysburg, even though when I live back in Chambersburg, Gettysburg is only a half an hour from us. The reason I don't is that area has been glorified, and it has been, it's a money-making machine there, and they take you through, and it looks like this is all very glorious. Take your students to Antietam. And if they go away from Antietam, I can tell you they'll go away from it pretty deadly serious. Because what they do is they have a museum there, and you walk into that museum, and they have a series of letters there, actual letters, actual script of what the men wrote before they went into battle the next day. And it's some pretty serious stuff. It's nothing about this bravery, can't wait to blow their brains out, this, that, and the other thing. Oh, no. Very different than that. A strong sentiment, I wish this war were over. You can't imagine the dread that I'm in about tomorrow. I know that. And it just letter after letter after letter after letter like that. And then they show you a film of the slaughter that went on. Now, it's not real gory, but it's enough to let you know that at the northern end of the battlefield, there was a cornfield. I forget the name of the cornfield, but the opening volley, there were men walking down through that cornfield in rank, and the Confederates opened fire on them from the sides and just mowed them down thousands at a time. By the time the battle was over, that cornfield was leveled. There was not one stalk standing. And there were thousands of dead people in it. It was the single goriest, bloodiest day of the Civil War. 22,000 men died in one day at this battle. But my point to you in telling you this story is to show to you that it is not the devices of men that make things come out the way they do. In fact, I challenge you to do a study of any major fight, conflict in world history. Read it carefully, and you will find in almost every case significant details of that story if it had not been for the sovereign hand of God descending and moving this way or moving that way or doing this or doing that. The outcome would have been totally different. Napoleon. He is credited as a great warrior, and I suppose he was. The Duke of Wellington is credited with being a great man who stopped Napoleon at Waterloo. I challenge that. It was a big storm the night before the Battle of Waterloo took place that stopped Napoleon. He intended to attack at 8 o'clock in the morning. He could not attack until 11 o'clock. Why? There was a big storm the night before and so much rain that when he went to pull out his artillery, it sunk into the axles and he couldn't move it. So he had to sit still until 11 o'clock. That gave plenty of time for the Duke of Wellington to pull up some forces, and it also made it impossible for Napoleon to pull the surprise attack. He lost. But why did he lose? Well, he lost because of a storm, not because the Duke of Wellington was so bright. Over and over and over and over again, these are the events that happen. I don't have time to do this, but if you want to tell the story even more powerfully, then you want to tell the story, you want to get one of those letters, a copy of it from down there at Antietam, and you want to copy the thing down, you want to read it to your students. Here's a young man, 17 years old, going off to battle tomorrow, and he's expecting to die. And these are his comments. It gives you a different perspective than how we flew over the Japanese and we flattened Hiroshima, mind you, we did.
That's a lot different than just taking a look at the individuals who actually were involved in the conflict and understanding the sovereign hand of God as He moved among men. Don't neglect the power of the story when you are teaching history. I wanted to say more about that, but we just are not going to have time to do that, and that's fine. Let's go back to lesson preparation. How do you actually pull this off? Well, those of you who have books, I'm going to explain to you what I'm going to do this year and what I do if I have time to do it. The way to get your act together for a history class is outlined right here. First of all, plan the year. How are you going to do that? Those of you who have a handout, you have a paper that looks like this. By the way, this will work for any subject. This is the best thing that I ever came up with. It works really well for me if I have time to pull it off. Okay, that means I have about 2 weeks here before school starts. I'm going to have to get it done for all my subjects. Notice facts, skills, concepts. Those of you who have a text, this is precisely what I do with that thing. I open that thing up to the table of contents, take a look at it, just to kind of refresh my memory for what the book is about. It's divided into units and all of that. And then I actually take that text, I lay it down beside me, and I begin to leaf through. What am I after? I want to know what facts I want the students to know at the end of the year. If they forget everything else by the time I'm done, these I want them to know. Okay? And I begin to compile them. Here are some for American history. Number one, I just made this list quickly before I came over here. The presidents of the United States in order with the dates. Those are facts. Okay? There's rhyme and reason to it. I'm going to have them memorize that. That's a fact I want them to know. And at the end of the year, when they heard me say that at the beginning of the year, they can be guaranteed the final test is going to ask them for those facts. Okay? Because that I want them to know at the end of the year. Number two, the 50 states and their capitals depends on the grade level. And you have to know. I'm not saying you should do all of these, you understand? I'm just giving you examples of what you would say to your students. Maybe you're teaching 5th and 6th grade. And maybe all the thing that you want to be sure they know by the end of the year is the 50 states and their capitals. And you tell them that right at the beginning of the year. That's a name. That's a fact we are going to learn. Three, oh, by the way, if you're teaching high school, you might want to add to that the date of these states' entry into the Union. I'll just read fast here, and if you want to jot them down, you can. Three, memorize the Bill of Rights or the 27 Amendments. I'm sorry, Heather, I know you don't want to teach this stuff up there where you come from, but that's all right. You get the drift, whatever it is. I mean, memorize the Queens and let Princess Diana out of it while you're at it. Okay, but you get the idea. Some other ones I have here. 1 year I decided I'd have the students learn the Supreme Court decisions. Why? In that year, I wanted to emphasize, and I don't even remember the reasons I decided to do that. There is a flow in American history that can be traced through the Supreme Court decisions that were made that decided a lot of things in this land. The presidents didn't decide. It was decided by the Supreme Court. The issue of abortion here in the early 70s, for example, decided by a Supreme Court decision. You might want to organize, you might want to have them study the wars of the United States. I don't do that one very quickly. However, I almost always ask on the final test, what are the dates of World War I? What are the dates of World War II? Who fought World War I? Who fought World War II? Who were the Axis powers? Who were the Central powers of World War I? I'm to ask them some questions that every American citizen ought to know. Okay? Number six, 20 events that describe the flow of American history. So there I might just choose out 20, list them on a piece of paper, and say, these are the 20 I want you to know. They can't memorize them all, can they? No. But here's some core material you want them to know, and it's under fact level. 7, memorize the Gettysburg Address. 8, rivers and mountains of America. 9, selected dates. Make your own list. But walk through and decide at the beginning of the year what it is you want your students to know. Go to skills. Think through in the same way. Number 1, I have. Draw a sketch of North America and show the states. That's different than fill in the blank. You ever try it? Okay. Because you know that if a student can take a blank piece of paper, sketch Europe, if that's what you're doing, and just block outline the nations and put their names in, they know them. Okay. So you might say at the beginning of the year, that's what I'm going to have you do as a skill. By the end of the year, you'll be able to do that. Number 2, locate any area on the map using lines of longitude and lines of latitude. So you give them 50 degrees east longitude, 40 degrees north latitude, and they are able to find it on the map. And if they get really good at it, then you should be able to give that to them and for them to think, oh yes, that must be in northeastern United States. Okay, if it's 70 degrees east and it's 40 degrees north, it's likely, eastern Pennsylvania? I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look in a map, but you know, somebody could tell me, you're in around eastern Pennsylvania somewhere, maybe New Jersey. I'd say, oh, they know what they're talking about, lines of longitude, lines of latitude. That's a skill, a map reading skill. Number 3, I hate these, I never give them to students. Outline a chapter, but they ought to learn how to do it. It's a skill that they should learn. 4, do a research paper from start to finish. Doing a research paper is a skill. I want to put in a plug here for faith builders. I wanted to say something to you about this. Every high school student, by the time they graduate, I don't care if it's 10th grade, that's fine with me. If they graduate from 10th or 12th, they should know how to do a research paper, and we should not have to teach them how to do them. Okay, that should be taught. And you can do that. Just set it as a goal. 6, draw a profile of North American topography. That means walk along and show where the Appalachian Mountains are, and then the drop down to the Mississippi River, and then the rise back up, and then the Rocky Mountains, and then the little plateaus in there, and then the Sierra Nevadas, and so on. Number 7, one that is more difficult, predict population growth areas. Okay, that's a skill. So you might want the students to be able to tell you or to make some kind of prediction what's going to happen in northwestern Pennsylvania over the next 50 years. Will it grow? Of course it will. That's where Faith Builders is located. No, seriously, if you teach students how to look at the factors that surround an issue, how much money is there, so forth and so on, you can do some prediction about growth. Okay? But that's a more abstract skill, right? I only gave you a smattering of them, but I'm telling you it'll help you if at the beginning of the year you line out some skills. What are some concepts that you might say, I want the students to know at the end of the year? Number 1, what is democracy? I have no idea I don't know how many times I have tried to explain the difference between a pure democracy and a republican democracy and the various kinds of democracies that may exist. And at the end of the year, people still look at you with a blank stare. What's a democracy? It's a concept. Here's one. I used this one as my theme 1 year. No people can be free unless they are self-disciplined. That's a concept that I'm just going to weave into my teaching all along. I want them at the end of the year, I want to ask them to demonstrate from American history how they know that's true. And have them walk through various ones. Number 3, do a right, left, center political categories. Separation of church and state. Causes of inflation. I was going to walk you through that particular concept. But see, if I had that listed as something I wanted to accomplish, which I don't know if I'd make that one as a year end, I really wanted them to be able to do that or not. But if I did, then I'd establish that, and when I got to that section in the book, I'd make sure I covered it. Constitutional government, public education, and so on. When you're done with that, you throw that one to the side, and you prepare the unit. Okay? So now you go back to the beginning of the book. You've got your broad outlines, and you're saying, so help me, God helping me, and my students keeping their health. This is what they're going to know by the end of the year. Okay? Now, you go back to the unit. And I don't have an overhead made up for that, but you just do the same thing, and it says the unit. Okay? And you walk through it, and you say, and those of you who have a book, turn to Unit 3, I believe it is. It was the one I had thought I would use as an example here. Unit 3 begins on page number... I thought I was to it here. 168, thank you. It's entitled Nation. That's the title of the unit. How many of you teach or study without looking at unit pages and this type of thing? I do. Sometimes not good. I want you to notice something on that page 168. Facts. What can you draw right straight from that page? Page 168. I think I'm on the right thing here. What's on the far left-hand side? Yeah, you've got a timeline. It just pops them right out to you. You could choose there real quickly. It wouldn't take you a lot of time to say, I want them to know when the Louisiana Purchase occurred. I want them to know when the Missouri Compromise was. I want them to know when Texas was annexed. Or you could have them do all of them, or whichever ones you decided upon. Those are facts under dates. Then you would start leafing through there and you would find some other facts. Now what we were going to do, if I'd have had you the whole time, I was going to have you just go right ahead and do that on that page that I have for you. And have you walk right through there in groups and get some facts down that you're going to teach, and then some skills. Let's be real quick there. For those of you who have books, I want you three right here to see if you can generate about three facts. And I want this table right here to see if you can find in your books there two skills that you'd like to teach. And table right back there. Hunt through your books and show me or tell me what concept you're going to center on. See if you can do that real fast. Listen in back there while this is being done. Give them 5 minutes. I'll have you out of here in 15 minutes. You don't have to try to be real impressive. All I want is just a few ideas of how this would work. You're working on the unit. You're working on the unit. The unit goes back through there a little ways. Two minutes here, and I'm going to have you cut loose and tell me what you would do. Yeah, you won't offend me if you get up and leave. That's fine. You're welcome to stay too. You can't use this when I'm going to give it to you. What I wrote down for skill, sing the Star Spangled Banner. Yeah. Believe it or not, when my son and his other fellows were over in Poland, when they traveled around to some of the different churches and visited and so on, and that was one of the most often asked for songs. They wanted them to sing the Star Spangled Banner. Yes, but it did. Of course, they sang other songs too, but they sang it. Those of us who went to public schools, we know it, so because we always used to sing it all the time. I don't know where they learned it to. I did wonder where my son Ryan learned the Star Spangled Banner, because I don't sing it every day, that's for sure. One more minute. I'm showing you how fast you get ready for the year. You see that? We're going to do it here in about 8 minutes. Okay, time's up. What facts do you have there, gentlemen, that you're going to teach?
Louisiana Purchase, who, the quote, "Don't give up the ship" from Perry, and the Great Awakening, some of the influential men. Benny.
Good. I had that one down. Great. Skill. Okay, draw a map. Okay, the outlining how the states lined up. Good. What else? You have any other skills there you're going to teach us?
Well, I can get some various map sketches, and also something like identify, if you're reading a book, be able to identify that these revival tactics come from the finish.
Okay, that would be a skill, sure. All right. They're a little hard to come by the way. Concepts. Causes of the Civil War. Okay? Somebody else. Reuben. Say again.
Development of religion.
Women's rights. Good.
Effects of the Second Great Awakening.
What do you got there? Oh, you don't have a book. Okay. Okay. That's fine. I had a whole pile of them down here I had 13. Women's rights was in them. Jeffersonian republicanism. If I developed that concept, what would we hammer on? The backbone of Jeffersonian republicanism is a small farmer. Now, if you take the small farmer away, you can't have Jeffersonian republicanism. Okay, and so I'm going to try to develop that concept and what I want to do. Ben, I'm putting in a plug for the small farmer, and I'm going to yell about the big farms and the consolidation and all the money involved, and I'm going to say, come on, get back to the small farm. Didn't break that, did it? Get back to the small farm. You Mennonite people, if you've forgotten how to live on a small farm, raise a few cows and plant a few crops, Jeffersonian republicanism, you can tell I like him. I like the idea. Okay. Implied powers, manifest destiny, the futility of war, foreign policy, the Monroe Doctrine, Jacksonian democracy. Now to flip my lid on that. Every time I read American history, I go back and forth between being just terribly upset at Andrew Jackson and think, well, yeah, he was kind of a hero after all. I never can quite decide. But normally I come out and say, boy, he started something that's a bad deal. I've actually even defended in American history class already that we should have maintained limited voting rights. Should have kept, Jefferson said, we're going to have small farms, and it's the landowners of those small farms who are going to vote, because they're the only people who have their heads on right. Before you laugh, I agree with him. I just about agree with him. I'm ready to defend that position. In the 1900s, we permitted the women to vote. Don't listen to me, but I'll tell you that was a mistake. Why, we elected John F. Kennedy just like that, based on his looks. In fact, you know that Mr. Clinton got into office because 60%, almost 60% of the women voted for him. Only 40% of the men voted for him. I'm talking about the people who actually voted. If it had gone by the men's vote, George Bush would have won the election. Not Clinton. Listen to me. Do you see that when you develop concepts, so you begin to speak into the lives of people, you're talking to them now about the issues of life. Okay, you're moving from fact to skill to concept. And when you walk into that concept, I'm sorry, you got to have opinions. And then you can speak into the issues that people are facing. Okay? We're out of time here, but let's just continue a little bit more. So it's obvious, what would you do next? You'd go to the chapter you're teaching. Okay? I chose chapter 10, which is within this unit. And again, we'll take 2 minutes to do exactly the same thing. The only thing is, you're doing facts, you're doing skill, you're doing concept. Okay, you're doing facts. Out of chapter 10, just see if you could scrape together a few basic facts that you would want your students to know. Out of chapter 10. And skills back there and concepts here. Two minutes here. Got 1 minute left. Okay, time's up. Let's see what we would do here. On the fact side, what do you gentlemen want to do? Anybody? Mike, you have some there?
For Jackson's views, Indian problems, trail tears, condition of banking, what was naturalism, secularism, opposition.
Okay, so you're going to give, you're going to have them define nationalism, sectionalism, and so on. Okay? Chris, you have some there? Sure, each of the presidents. I failed to say this when you're developing this, so you'd go back and check your year-long schedule. And so if you were learning the presidents, say that was the deal, then you would want some of your facts in here to keep you up to date with the presidents. And so you'd have to be saying, I want you to know the presidents from Jackson to Lincoln or whatever. Okay? And so you, because normally those, that big body of material to learn, you want to do it in increments. So you do it, you schedule it in your fact, skill, concept plan for the chapter. Okay? How about over here? Okay, good. All right, skills back here. What are we after with skills? Okay, there you go. So there's a skill. You're going to do an announcement poster? Did you?
There was one here. Make sure they know how to do it.
Okay, good. Excellent. What else? You guys have something dreamed up over there? Okay. One I thought of, if you look on page 204, I'm not a coin collector, but you could, currency is being discussed, right? Okay. You could tell them about the skill of coin collecting, or if you're really good at it, you might even help them to know how to discover a counterfeit. Talking about all kinds of currencies there. That'd be a little wild, but I'm just saying, you might consider that. You might say that might be a skill I want them to learn, know about. All right, concepts.
Our Jackson's administration, like his attack on the central bank, the spoil system. Yeah. Let me just think in the impact of that. Racism in relation to the Cherokee Indians, and then the development of political parties as the Jackson administration went on that divided people.
Great. One of them that I thought of in there was the pros and cons of the tariff. That'd be a great one. It's probably one that I would work at in particular, because, well, yeah, we don't have time to go into it. Great. Sounds good. And finally, now what are we going to do? We're going to go back to chapter 10, and we're going to say, okay, we're going to develop our lesson. How many lessons are we going to divide this into? And so if we by our beginning year, we're going to just go right ahead. By our beginning year plan, we're going to go right ahead and say, well, let's see, that's from page 192 to 210. I'm going to do that in two lessons or three lessons, depending on how much time I want to give to it. So if you're doing from pages 192 to 197 or whatever, then you would go right through and you'd do the same thing, facts, skills, and concepts. You got the idea. Okay, I won't have you do it again, but I will promise you, I will guarantee you, if you use that process in developing your history lessons, it'll bring some rhyme and reason to it. Okay? If you just remember that every good lesson has those three categories, and if you take it from the macro sense to the micro sense, so that when you walk into the classroom today and you're getting ready to teach that class, you know what you want to accomplish during the whole year in all three of those categories, and you're building that direction all the time so that by the end of the year they know that. You know how it fits in the smaller picture of the unit, you know how it fits in the chapter, and you know what you're going to do today. You know the facts you're going to teach, you know the skills you're going to teach, and you know the concepts you're going to teach. Don't get on yourself if, in fact, you can't drum up a skill. I'd want to be very clear on that. In fact, you, depending on what level you're teaching, you may be wanting to work on a skill for 2 or 3 weeks. If you're doing a research paper, it's going to take a while to do that one. So you're helping them with that. Or you might have map study skills, you know, for 2 weeks or a week or whatever. But nevertheless, for me, it has helped to bring rhyme and reason into what I'm doing on a daily basis and help me to see where it fits in the larger picture. Now, I've said all this today to help you to understand. To be a good history teacher does not mean that you are able to come in and, like an encyclopedia, just pour it all out. That's nice if you can. And it's nice if you're very enthused, and it's nice if you know the subject so well you can just almost plume right through it. Chances are many of us will come to the class day after day and we're not that way. I can tell you, you still will get something significant accomplished in that class if you walk in and you know these are the facts, these are the skills, these are the concepts that I want this student to learn. And if you let them those concepts grow on you enough that you know that if they get a hold of this idea that I'm trying to explain to them and show to them, like I just got done doing with Jeffersonian democracy, then, I mean, that's what puts the enthusiasm in what you're doing, because you really want to help them to understand something that at least you think you've understood and that you want them to learn. So they go out of there not with the idea that they're going to build a 500 dairy farm, but rather they're going to, if they're a dairy farm, they have 40 cows or 50 cows or whatever. Hey, that's the kind of democracy they have. You can begin to extend that right into the church. For example, depending on what class I was with, I might say, how many of your churches permit the women to vote? Okay, and see how many of them flag their hands around a little while. and ask them those kinds of questions, you know, and help them to see that, well, and then ask them, well, 50 years ago, did they permit the women to vote in your church? And how many issues are they permitted to help choose the ministry, you know, directly? And so forth and so on. You got the idea. Okay? Any questions or comments?
Are you saying that
every lesson should have a concept? For it to feel good for me, when I'm studying for a lesson, if I'm coming away with that thing with just facts and maybe even a skill, I know it's not going to be a good class. Okay? When I say it's not going to be a good class, I mean, it'll be okay. But for it to have energy in it, I have to have read that thing and said, oh yeah, oh yeah, you wait. I can't wait to tell them that. And to walk into that and explain that. Then it gives, well, the concept is what gives substance to facts and skills. Okay, so if you don't have that, well, it's not like you're not teaching anything, but it's that it'll lack energy. Yeah. Any other questions?
I had another question.
Sure.
Back to developing more resources.
Yes. You're going to count me a heretic because I use a secular book for my main history book. It's put out by Houghton Mifflin, and it's called The World in History. I hesitate to even give one to you because that's an older book, 70s. Okay, for you, if you haven't got your core book yet, I'd choose one that's more up to date. And a lot of these books that are put out by secular writers are very good in that sense because they have all kinds of annotations. Buy a teacher's manual. That's what I like. The teacher's book that has all the stuff in the margins and all that kind of stuff, the sidelines, sidelight ideas and so forth and so on. So I can't just say, okay, here's a book that you should get. Now, we just chose a world history book for TAP class. And what I'm going to do is settle down and buckle down and master that one. Okay, it'll probably be my new resource book. Okay, what other questions do you have? Well, thank you for hanging on here for 15 minutes or so. I hope you're all great history teachers. There's an awful lot that I would have liked to have said about the subject to inspire you about it. I think that if I were required to give up teaching a number of subjects, my two favorites, I was hired to teach mathematics and science because that was my thing in school. Over the years, it has changed. Given a choice now, if I had to get rid of some, I'd get rid of English first. The two that I would retain, I'll say it this way, the two that I would retain would be Old Testament and history. I love to teach church history and world history and American history, and I like Old Testament, which is history too. I don't say that because everybody should think that. I'm just saying that somehow or another that just fits my hand right. And I like to talk to students about life from that context. And so I just encourage you, if the Lord has given you a heart for it, well, develop those core resources, get the stuff together, and you'll do your students a favor. You're dismissed.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.